Hi, and welcome to the Let's K-12 Better podcast. This podcast is a project between Mama Ball Capes and her kids.
Hi!
In our podcast, we will cover a variety of subjects involving K-12 education and family life.
We will talk about the ways that parents, kids, and educators can improve K-12 education and family life.
We encourage you to join our conversation on social media using the hashtag #LetsK12Better.
Let's jump into episode 16 of the Let's K12 Better podcast.
Right now, families across the country are inundated with information about COVID-19 and back to school. Some of it good and some of it misleading. It's hard to keep up with the decisions being made by each state and every school district in response to the recommendations from health officials. The reality is that school, although not a childcare facility, provides parents the ability to work as schools promise a structured and safe environment for kids. As we hear about the demands to jumpstart the economy and the real need for families to earn income, we can't help but wonder if there isn't a better, more imaginative way that we aren't pursuing. This episode is part of a back-to-school series focused on a variety of topics designed to peek behind the curtain or even blur the lines a bit between the parent-teacher realm. We hope that you gain insight into the human stories behind the hysteria, the confusion, and even the sterile numbers and factoids we hear in the media. In March, the sentiment across the board was that teachers need to be paid more for all the work that they do. But it seems as if the narrative has shifted. We're all still dependent upon one another for the success of our children, so what has changed?
This week, we sat down with Dr. Lindsay Portnoy, a mother, author, cognitive scientist, and school board president, and Corwin Collier, a father, educator, track coach, and veteran. In this episode, we hope that you can connect with their concerns around balancing logistics and student well-being.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lindsay Portnoy. I'm a cognitive scientist and an associate professor at Northeastern University. I'm a former educator and EdTech co-founder and the author of Design to Learn and the forthcoming book, Game On, Brain On.
There are many details and moving parts that go into making a decision about school at this moment. What do you anticipate as the greatest challenge in your role as school board president?
So as school board president, I think one of the biggest challenges is going to be dealing with the fact that no matter what decisions we make, people are going to be very angry with us. And just like so many different decisions that we have to make, I might not personally agree with the decision, but oftentimes because of the role, and this also I think is even at the university and as a mom and in wearing all the different hats, just being comfortable with, you know, doing what's best for everyone that might not always be best for you or what your family would choose.
There are a lot of concerns and fears right now for all involved. But what are things that you wish parents understood during the process of reopening?
So the process of reopening schools is complicated. Obviously, that's an understatement. I just wish that we could change the conversation from getting our kids face-to-face in a classroom to acknowledging that there's a really great opportunity here to change the way that we do instruction. So in terms of the process, everyone's very worried about measuring 6 feet and, you know, that the kids, you know, should be eating in the classroom, which of course is going to limit. I wish parents understood that if kids went back to school, it wouldn't be the same way that they think of as school. School's not going to feel the way that they think it's going to feel. And so kids are going to be quite separated, and it's not going to be a magical process. I think opening school is complicated for a host of reasons. I think that you're asking people to privilege whose education and what type of education is most important and in what space. And that's a really tough call, because no matter, again, similar to the first question, no matter where you stand, you're going to make people angry, and rightly so. But I think it's a really great opportunity to have the conversation about the distinction between equity and equality. And everyone now wants equality. Everyone wants equal. If your kid gets this, I want my kid to get that. That's equality. But equity is everybody gets what they need. And so if that means that our kids who have related services are the ones that are privileged and get space first, and so we make sure that those kids are spread across the schools so they have access to the supports that they need, and that means that other kids are not in school, you know, that might be, you know, not seeming equal, right? But that's what's equitable. That's what's needed for our younger kids that are learning how to read and write and might need more direct support and direct contact with teachers, right? So like those sorts of things are really, you know, they're hard decisions to make. And again, everyone's going to be mad no matter what you do. And I also think, you know, we talk a lot about kids and everyone's saying, well, kids are not spreading this, kids are not spreading this. And we're not certain, right? We closed schools. So we don't really have a good case to argue that kids are not spreading this, but regardless of whether or not kids are spreading this, there are a bunch of grownups in those buildings, and each child is going to come into contact with grownups, and those grownups are going to go home and come into contact with other grownups. And so I think that we're putting communities into exponential danger unnecessarily. I don't know. We have childcare. Our New York State Cuomo has mandated that we have childcare on premise for first responders and for essential personnel, that they can have their children there, which is an incredible thing. And our school has been wonderful, making sure that the support services are there for kids. The point at which so many of our kids are children of those essential workers, and we do live in a town where we do have a host of teachers and folks that are going to have to go back full time. I'm worried about, you know, what it's going to look like to have to staff those spaces. And then I think about what are substitutes, you know, are we going to be able to find substitutes, and what happens if our teachers do get sick? I mean, I don't want to see anyone get sick with this. I'm uncomfortable putting any life at risk because of a decision that I make. I don't think it should be up to me to decide the health of others.
Yeah. Well, our district didn't even let us make the choice. They said everyone's virtual until January 29th, when the first semester is done. We'll talk after that. And it made parents angry, but every forum, I just kept posting, thank you very much for making it very easy for people to just have to deal with a solution, right? Like they were like, boom, this is what we're doing, January 29th. And then they wrote in huge capital letters, we might come back based on the numbers and the health of the state of Maryland, as well as Montgomery County. And so I said, just the fact that you said, we're not coming back, we might come back. And again, I get it. There are kids with special needs that need to be in school. There are ESL kids, there, the, you know, our younger kids, the equity issues, you know, our district will figure it out. But again, we have like mad people. They were trying to just think about the busing. They probably looked at logistics of this. How many trips to the neighborhood can y'all do if you're only letting 12 kids on a bus at a time? How long is just the commute to school? And then how long is the commute home? Who gets to get on that bus first? It's just so.
And what are they going to do? They're going to put tents so kids can sit in groups of 10 under tents and waiting for the bus? Like, what are we at the airport?
Right?
Like, that's no fun for anybody. Why are we replicating that? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say it when you were saying that, I was thinking about how smart it is that your school system did that. It's easy to say what would happen if I was in charge. However, I would really hope that I would make a hard but quick decision, because I think the longer that we have people wait, you know, you and I talk about this all the time, that the drivers for any behavior are largely, you know, uncertainty and fear. And so I think mm-hmm. that both of those things are preying on people right now. And if we were just to say, look, this is not a safe situation, this is not a good situation, we're just going to call it right now and make people angry, mm-hmm. and then you'll get over it. But
right.
It's like ripping off the Band-Aid. When you're saying that, I was like,
right.
Oh my gosh, this is ripping off the Band-Aid. Like, just do it, just call it off, and
people
put all
pissed.
Of your energy. oh, but why aren't we putting our energy
fine?
Yeah, but why don't my biggest beef or seitan, because we're vegan, but my biggest like protein source is that we're not spending this time helping our teachers and our kids learn how to navigate learning in a virtual space. Instead, we're spending all of our resources trying to calculate and measure 6 feet apart in buses, in classrooms, moving furniture. The incredible amount of human brain power that has been used to solve this problem is magnificent. Imagine if we use all that brain power to really fix education and make it better for every kid, not just keeping kids 6 feet away so they can get back to school, but really use this as an opportunity to change.
That soundbite right there, I'm going to use that. I hope you don't mind. Like,
that's fine. I think that's the place to stop. Everyone has a device now. Why? Because the government has decided that everyone should be funded one-to-one. The minute that we're talking about making Wi-Fi, a service the way that we provide water, I mean, there's no reason why we can't change. Everyone, is getting what they need to function this way. Like, let's move. Let's push this needle.
Hey, freaking man. I love you. Okay,
awesome. Sorry.
Move to question number five.
Yeah, sorry.
Which is something that you've already kind of touched upon. Traveling the world of parent educator. Okay, so you kind of already touched upon this a bit. So I'm going to move to the next question.
The only thing I'm worried about there is like, no, it's fine. I was just thinking like, it's weird because, yeah, I'm a mom and I'm in education, but my students are teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
you
want to
talk about that a little bit, right? Like,
I don't know. I mean, Do you think that that's important or relevant? I just think about like, how do we give like as in academe, right? So I have students that are, getting their doctorate and they are school leaders and they are assistant superintendents and they are, grade leaders. They're these incredible human beings. And so how am I going to make sure to give them the space that they need to do what they need to do and to be able to take care of themselves and their mental health while also helping them keep moving forward in their learning? I'm really worried about making sure that I can show up for my students because, I mean, I love education and I want to be there for them. And I'm worried that if they're going to be asked to go back to school, I don't want them to put themselves in a bad place. And so I think about that on the board. I think about my students as teachers and I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm so uncomfortable with the relationship I have with my students, feeling like I would be making that decision for the teachers in our school. It just doesn't feel right. I just don't feel like it's my choice, or it should be. It should be their choice.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate your candidness and vulnerability. Oh, you're a real one.
It's a problem. Working on it.
No, don't work on it. That's your strength. So, we hear about the various districts and their plans to reopen. Can you talk a bit about what you guys have decided, if you feel comfortable, and, what impact, you're going to do what you're going to do with your kids, and then what is impacting your decision as a parent, and what are your own kids saying to you?
In terms of the district, so we're in New York State, and I think largely it's going to be a mandate from the state. What's going to happen right now, we've been asked to submit plans for in-person, hybrid, and distance learning. So our district, I think, is still sort of juggling with this idea. For my own kids, look, we've been talking about it at home a bunch. I'm not very comfortable making a health choice for others. So for right now, I'm pretty confident in saying that I would want my kids to be learning at home. And my opinion is that even if everyone does go back to school full time, within a month, we're all going to be home anyway. So I don't know. I feel very strongly that regardless of what we choose for the fall, and I think we're probably going to stay home, everyone's going to end up in home at some point anyway. And my kids are nervous. Like my kids, they see it, they hear about it, and they're anxious, they're nervous. They don't want to be part of it. They don't want to be part of spreading it. And we try to talk about it, right? Like we do like the science thing, like let's talk about a virus and what does it look like and how does it work and why is it impacting people and why are some people disproportionately impacted more than others? And it's always a nice conversation to talk, well, not nice, but it's an interesting way for us to have a conversation about access to healthcare and why are certain, you know, we're in New York, it was a hotspot, why? What is it about New York that would be a hotspot? Well, we're a big city. Well, what does that mean about being in a big city and who has access to hospitals and where's our hospital and who do you see in the hospital? So, you know, in that sense, it's been interesting. And I don't know if you're going to go here, Amber, but one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot during this time is that, you know, we see that there's a lot of civil unrest, thank goodness. People are agitating and good ways. We're a captive audience. So we're being held captive in our homes and we are a captive audience and we are being forced to reckon with things that I don't believe we've ever had the space, the time, or frankly, the bandwidth to talk about. Or maybe we have and just have been blind, but we can't. And so I think that, you know, this again, I hate saying the gift of COVID, but it's been a gift that we are having these forced conversations that I really think are gonna, I'm feeling positive are gonna change for the better. I hope.
No, thank you for throwing that in there. Yes. When thinking about the disruption of student learning and the inequities revealed this past spring, you know, maybe this moment you've been talking about this possesses an opportunity to reimagine student learning.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about what, you know, just general thoughts or thoughts of what it could be, thoughts on what you would love to see? Please fill your gut.
Something really magical happened this spring. All of a sudden, these standardized assessments that have lived with us for far too long, that people have been railing against for as long as I can remember, they disappeared. And magically, we're all still here. We have all still survived. And what we saw, and this I think is very much a system thinking perspective, is that when one thing changes, it impacts another, it impacts another, it impacts another. And what did we see? We saw that institutions of higher education went and started talking about, well, maybe we're going to have SAT optional for the next, you know, a couple of years of incoming classes. And then we started seeing folks like the Mastery Transcript Consortium come out and more schools are thinking about, well, what does it look like to go towards more of a qualitative feedback system so that we're not stamping kids with arbitrary letters or numbers that define them from here until eternity, but rather giving them rich feedback that helps them grow and helps them thrive and helps them actualize this whole, you know, notion of mindset. We talk about mindset. I know you and I talk about this all the time. We talk about growth mindset, but we don't practice growth mindset. We can practice growth mindset now. The Regents, out the window. AP, IB, these exams, they're not there right now. The third through eighth grade ELA and math tests, they were canceled. You know, the nicest slot test I know in New York, our friends were thrilled when they were canceled. So we can start thinking about what does it mean to really learn? What is knowledge? How do we make knowledge? How do we create knowledge? How do we co-create knowledge together? How do we acknowledge that there are experts in fields? And how do we acknowledge that sometimes the teacher isn't the expert? Sometimes the teacher is the expert at facilitating good question asking and curiosity, but that we can go outside the school and that a group of kids who is learning in, you know, New York where we live can get on a Skype call with a scientist in the middle of the Pacific Ocean who's doing research, right? And still, you know, the scientist is the one who has the knowledge, but the teacher is curating this experience and guiding the kids to learn and see and know what it means to do science and not sitting, you know, at a desk in a classroom and reading from a book. So I think we have a great potential now. I think that we've seen that the world will not stop if the tests go away. And in fact, in my opinion, I think that the world just opened up and we'd be remiss to not take this opportunity.
Thank you for that. I just want to put like music behind it and like angels and just.
But what do we do? Like, how do we make it be?
I have definitely adjusted what my expectations for my kids are, you know, especially after I had a student who was waitlisted and was like, dang, I'm not actually getting into this college now because they've shrunk the incoming freshman class to account for virtual what's happening in the world. And I was like, huh, that's so interesting. Like, what, you know, what is college going to be like? So that we tie this up in a bow, right? Do you have any, like, additional thoughts or encouragements or even, like, warnings that you want to share?
I don't know. I mean, something you said a minute ago is making me think about, you know, Northeastern is also trying to figure out what back to school is going to be like for our students, right? And a lot of parents who are sending their kids to school, you know, they want a discount in tuition if their kids are not going to be in person. So on the one hand, I think it's a beautiful thing that we're finally valuing human connection. Like, finally, we're getting up and we're standing on a soapbox and saying, no, it's important that we have human connection. I don't know, if not that we've never said that before, but even the idea of walking across campus and going and sitting in a class and just even the moments before class. I mean, right? I remember in college, that was a big deal, and there's a huge social component to it. But I wonder the point at which, what are you getting out of what you pay for college? What is the value of what you're getting in college? And a lot of it is the faculty that they have, right? You want to have the top faculty. You want to have folks that know how to educate and inspire students. I don't know. It just makes me wonder about the value of higher education, and not that there is no value. I think there's tremendous value. I think it's how we value it that maybe needs to change, right? Like, you can still have incredible humans. I've been teaching online for a while now, and my colleagues in the grad school of ed at Northeastern are some of the most incredible educators and most brilliant minds I've worked with, I've had the pleasure to work with. And they teach online. And so I think about it, I'm like, my goodness, if my kids were their students, I'd be thrilled. It would be worth every penny, because that is the purpose of education, right? So I don't know. I struggle with the whole, I don't want to pay tuition, or tuition should be reduced because of in-person class. There's, like, a lot of really strange stuff. I'm trying to think of something profound to say. I don't know if I have anything. I know that I'm going to make a lot of people angry this fall, and it's not my intention. And I feel like it's an impossible, impossible decision. And I think a lot of people are putting, I don't know how it is in other states, frankly. In our state, it's going to come to the governor. He's going to tell us what's going to happen, and we're just going to go with it, and that's what's going to be. And parents are probably going to have a choice if it's in person to go or not. And, you know, everyone's screaming at the board. Ultimately, it's not really our choice. It's out of our hands. Like, that's for real.
I think that's an excellent point. I think that clarification is very key, so that people understand the layers of government and civics in this moment too, right?
You should do an episode like how to do school board stuff, because I think, like, I see so often, I get emails as a board member from people who have X, Y, and Z complaints, or I'll see someone on the street or at the bus stop or the grocery store, and they have questions, and they're angry and they're frustrated and they want to tell you, and for sure, I hear everyone out. And I think that people need to know what the process is, because when I explain to them how it should work, they're like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Let me go do that. And then they do that, and oftentimes it's resolved. So, like, there's a system for a reason, and there's a process for a reason, and there's a board for a reason. But, like, you know, you follow the process to get them, right?
You hit the nail on the head. I actually, you're actually right, because this will actually tie into what I interviewed this dude who our district has. So we have 7 high schools in our district. So, you know, so he was telling, you know, how the school board parent advocacy works within our cluster, because, you know, what the school board has done is, like, this cluster, you know, you all have representatives who come to these board meetings, who engage with us, who speak on your behalf. You all can come, you know, but since it's so many people, they've had to organize it that way. And so his episode, which is part of this back to school series, is parent advocacy at, you know, with the school board, not against the school board, but at the school board level. But
yeah.
I think that you're right. There needs to be an episode about, like, how does the school board work? Because people don't realize, like, hey, like, the state of Maryland, just like every other state, has a Department of Ed, you know? And they also have a Maryland school board. Like, we have a Maryland school board, you know? Like,
we have a, so, yeah, we have a, right, we've got a board right. of regents. I mean, everybody's different, right. but I think, like, but that's the point, right? And so you were saying at first that you're, the school board person was talking about how they've set up the hierarchy so that everyone could have a voice in your massive district. It's context. So we have a teeny tiny mm-hmm. district, and everybody is able to speak their voice because we can hear everyone. So then my question is, okay, well, in such a massive district, if you have a concern and the person representing you doesn't know or think that that's a valid concern, does it get raised? And like, those are sort of like the uncomfortable conversations that we have where someone's yeah. like, you know, I was frustrated about X. I went to this person. It wasn't resolved. And then they escalate. It's really, it's a matter of escalation.
Yo, amen to that. Amen to that. I think that this was super dope. Wait, let me make sure.
We hope that you enjoyed part one of this two-part episode, How Can Parents and Educators Work Together During This Very Stressful Time to Create Learning Environments That Benefit the School Community? If you have anything that you'd like to share, please connect with us on social media at Let's K-12 Better on all social media platforms, or you can connect with me on Twitter and Instagram at Mom of All Capes. Check out part two of this discussion available right away. We'll see you in part two.
Welcome to part two of the Back to School episode discussing COVID-19 with parents and educators on the Let's K-12 Better podcast. In part one of this two-part episode, we heard from Dr. Lindsay Portnoy. In part two, we sat down with high school teacher Corwin Collier. Please enjoy the discussion in part two.
My name is Corwin Collier. I am a father of three boys and a husband of 12 years. I got into education about 8 years ago. I've been teaching for 8 years now. I got into education back in 2010 once I came home from Iraq. I used to be a soldier, a military police. I was injured in Iraq, unfortunately, and had to revamp and choose a different career. And so I wanted to go into education because I love working with kids and I love working with high school kids in particular. I teach high school social studies, American history in particular, and I also teach African American history, which is a great class for me to teach in an urban school district. I'm a coach as well. I'm the head track coach for the high school that I currently teach at. I teach at Maple Heights High School. It's the same high school that I graduated from, so it's a blessing to be back and given to the same community that I once was a part of. So that's it.
Shout out to Maple Heights. Mm-hmm. Well, what? So mm-hmm. proud to be from there. I will say that I'm going to come back to you later on to do just a full episode on, like, why it's important for Black men to teach, right, and why you teach in the community that you grew up in. So, like, be prepared for that. Like, downward.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So, we will jump into these questions. I just have a couple, right, for you. So, this first question I'm going to ask is, there are many details and moving parts that go into making a decision about schools in this moment. What do you anticipate as the greatest challenge in your role as an educator?
Honestly, my biggest role would probably be safety and creating a place for where kids feel emotionally and physically safe in the classroom. Granted, I'm teaching in a high school setting, so it's a little easier to kind of like navigate as far as, you know, masks, social distancing and things of that nature. So my biggest concern is just making sure that everyone feels that it feels comfortable. You know, right now, I don't know how many students have chosen to do the hybrid model versus the online model. Once I get those numbers, kind of help me understand what I'm looking at inside of the classroom. For me personally, I'm more worried about what I could bring home to my family versus myself. I feel like that, I guess, me being military experience and things like that, I've experienced so much danger, especially being deployed, that I guess I don't really look at this as everyone else looks at it. I think I have a different type of mentality. Like, I'm used to leaving the wire of a military base, not knowing whether I'm going to live or die. And this is kind of like the same thing for most people and civilians, and especially dealing with their kids and things like that. You don't know if someone's going to get it and then how they may react to it. So I think I'm more concerned about others than my own self as right now, which sounds crazy, but I'm more worried about my family and protecting them, and I'm worried about my students and protecting them. I guess it's that military complex that I have, protect all those around me.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then, first of all, that does not sound crazy, like, in the slightest. So, you know, I really appreciate the perspective that you're bringing to this discussion. So, like, with that, like, you kind of touched upon this already, but if you could go a little bit deeper into, like, you're straddling this world of being a parent and also being an educator, right? So, like, you kind of talked about what's going on in your mind during this time, but, like, if you can even expand more on that, like, you know, like, into your responsibilities and into, you know, how you're even, like, parenting, you know, maybe different or the same. Like, you know, what are you thinking about? What are you grappling with in this moment?
For me as a parent, it's difficult because you're watching your kids, especially, like, my two adolescent sons, who are 16 and 13, and I'm watching them as far as the social and emotional aspect. You know, they need that peace. They need friends. They need to be able to interact with people. And what we think in our minds, as we live in this 21st century, we're thinking that, oh, we have Zoom, we have FaceTime, but as I'm being a parent, I'm realizing that's not enough. So I have found a way to be able to, you know, connect with other parents that I know that have taken precautions in the beginning of this to allow my sons to be able to hang out with those friends that, you know, parents who did work at home and did not go anywhere, and, you know, they took all the precautions. So I have a very small select group of people within my circle that I allow my kids to be able to connect with because they need that. I watched the struggles in the beginning of March and April of the mental aspect, and it makes me wonder about other kids and how they're dealing with it mentally, especially at this age. Now, my 8-year-old son, on the other hand, you know, he's happy as long as he can go outside and do little things. He's not I don't think he's as attached to friendship as much, because at that age, you kind of like, you know, one minute you got one set of friends and you got another set of friends. So he's more happy that he gets to go outside, that he gets to still, you know, do normal everyday things. He didn't really feel the brunt of everything until just right now, when they canceled football season for him. He was looking forward to it. He already lost, you know, summer track, you know, and now he's about to lose football. So that's where I'm looking at it for him. Like, you know, he, at least if he goes to school, he has a two, where he's going to go to school like about 2 days out of the week, which I'm comfortable with him going to school 2 days out of the week and, you know, doing online the other 3 days. So, but I want him to at least still be able to be around other kids his age, you know, to be able to kind of like experience that. And I think he's been in our house long enough to where we've had conversations about social distancing, the importance of him keeping on his mask. And so he's intelligent enough to understand that he has to be able to be prepared for what's going to happen over the next few months.
I really appreciate you sharing that part of it. I think the value of friendships for preteens is kind of underestimated, especially because now they have smartphones. So people are like, right. Oh, you have a phone, you're fine, you know, whatever. It's like, no, they
They need to be in a room with their friends. So you talked about this just now, just a bit with like sports. I know my athletes were a bit devastated because we all summer camps, you know, I was like, you're not going to summer camp. You're not going to summer lacrosse tournaments. You're not doing sports right now. I know you're raising athletes, you know, student athletes, and you coach. So can you talk a bit about like what this moment has been for athletes and like how you're dealing with that as a coach and as a parent of athletes?
All right. Well, from the coaching perspective, it was hard because I had just took over Maple Heights High School's track program. We had this fabulous indoor season. And I mean, it was the best that Maple had ever had done at that time. We had qualified so many people for the indoor state championships. And then we were looking forward to outdoor season starting. And so then all of this happened right in the midst of that getting ready to start. So it's kind of like it was hard for me to kind of like try to let seniors know that who were probably about to have one of the best seasons of their high school lives, to see my seniors say, like, this is it, like, not have the opportunity to have an outdoor season. And on the flip side, I saw my son, who was the number one ranked freshman in the hurdles during indoor season, he was top in the state, and he was the number one ranked freshman in the nation. I saw him lose an opportunity to kind of like go this outdoor season to really show out. And so it was hard to deal with that. And for a moment, I think it messed with him. Once again, this is where that social emotional part came into play, you know, because he is a big time track runner and he lost one. And last year, last summer he sat out because he was hurt. He finally was back healthy and he was having a great season. And so then this happened. So it was hard as a parent to see your athlete, you know, lose a season. And so now I'm looking at football, and right now middle school and high school football is a go. So I'm happy that my two older sons, that the middle schooler and the high schooler, are right now getting to play football. But like I said, it sucks because, you know, they canceled youth football for my youngest son, and it's kind of like he looked forward to it. It was the one thing he looked forward to. It's a good thing that me being a father that I am, and I work out as much as I do, he kind of works out with me, and he kind of trains with me and does little things with me. So it's a blessing that he's motivated. Now he was like, all right, well, football may not happen, but we going to have a track season, hopefully in the spring. So he's motivated to kind of like be able to at least do something. And then I always tell him that, you know, you're only eight, you know, you got time. It's not like this is going anywhere. So that's the blessing and the curse of it.
Well, it sounds like you're helping him keep it in perspective, which is great. So my fingers are crossed for y'all for this fall. For real. So we live in Maryland and all of our sports are canceled. Even I think the winter season is canceled.
As of right now, we got a first day of practice for fall sports is August 1st, supposed to be August 1st, which is Saturday. But our governor has not canceled anything. They're like really pushing towards it. I think the way football season is looking, it's probably looking like the NBA. It's going to be like nobody there, like nobody's allowed in the game type deal. Mm-hmm. Like the teams play, they're talking about cutting half time down to like from 12 minutes to 6 minutes. It's kind of like to get the games going, get them over with, boom, get everybody home. Mm-hmm. So volleyball, I don't think they're too like, and then cross country is like the outside running. So the only thing that I can think about with cross country is the starting line, like you pile up, because I think cross country be having like 50 people piled together.
That sounds more great. Wow. Well, I will definitely check back with you to see how that goes because, again, like it was a bummer to hear. And like, again, like my daughter's, my 12-year-old lacrosse team, club team, they're like, we're going to have tryouts in August. And like, I was like, Montgomery County said no sports. So I don't know if I'm going to ever come out if we can't even do anything in the fall, like, you know, so
we shall see. But that kind of leads into our next question. So sounds like, you know, your district or your state is trying to get this sports thing going, which our district and our state has kind of shut it down. You know, since there are a lot of different states doing a lot of different things, like, what is the plan like for your district? Like, and what have they said to like teachers and parents about like y'all's plan moving forward with school?
Okay, for our district, Maple Heights district, is what we're going to do. Parents have two choices. You have option A, complete virtual, or option B, which will be a hybrid option. If you do the hybrid, now either plan you pick, you have to stick with it for the entire semester, so you cannot change until January. So once Christmas break is over with and we come back for a new semester, then you're allowed to change what you plan to do. So if you do the hybrid model, of course, we know what virtual means. That means you're just at home all day, every day. If you do the hybrid model, you come to school, you're going to either be in Group A or Group B. Group A comes to school on Monday and Tuesday. And then Wednesday, no one comes to school. It's a deep cleaning day. The building is supposed to be clean, all this other kind of stuff. I believe the teachers are going to be there because we're going to be doing PD or virtual learning, but the teachers got to come on Wednesday. So we'll be the only ones in the building. And then Thursday and Friday, Group B comes to school, and they will be the ones doing the while Group A is at home doing online learning, Group B is at school doing in-person learning. Now, like I told you earlier, I don't know the numbers of this. I don't know what's going on with this yet because people have until the 31st to make a decision on what they plan on doing. And then once they make that decision, that's when we're going to start going. And the main reason why you cannot change and say, oh, I want to go to in face is because once we have the numbers, we know what the classrooms are going to look like. We know how we're going to social distance. We know all that stuff. And so once we get those numbers into place, we know how the building is going to be ran safely. So that's why we're saying once you make a decision, you know you won't have to stick with the decision. Now, if you want to go virtual, I think that might not be an issue. Like, say you decide that it might just be easier for you just to stay home, then I think that decision might be allowed. But as far as if you want to try to come back into the building, that might not be allowed.
And so I have a follow-up question for you. Like, so are you expected to hold all of the sessions, or are some educators going to, like, do the virtual ones only? Like, how does that work for you as the teacher?
That's a good question, and hopefully I'll find out when I go to we're reporting back to work 2 weeks early. So we're supposed to be doing a whole bunch of professional development and everything. We push school back 2 weeks, and teachers and stuff were supposed to report 2 weeks early. And we just did a survey as educators to say, you know, about health issues, you know, who feels comfortable, who don't feel comfortable. So, yeah, there might be some teachers that may be just strictly online teachers and other teachers that may be doing both. I don't know the entire logistics of it because I believe they're just waiting on the final numbers from parents saying who's coming to school, who's not coming to school.
What are your own kids saying to you, like, not your students, but like your own, like, sons? Like, what are they telling you right now? What are they expressing to you? What are y'all discussing in this moment? How are they feeling?
Honestly, my sons are saying, get them the hell out the house. they was like, give me the hybrid model. Do not put me in this house all day and want me to do work. And I'm gonna be
any
honest with you, like,
reason why?
They once they did the 9 weeks like that, they just can't do it. And to be honest with you, I had a schedule. I'm not like, I probably was different than every other parent out there. Like, my sons had a wake up time. They had a schedule. Like, let me break this down. When we was like, all right, this is how this is gonna work. Wake up is 8 o'clock. You got between 8 and 9 o'clock to get breakfast, get your face washed, teeth, all that kind of stuff. From 9 to 12, you were to utilize that time to log on and do your classwork and get your schoolwork done. Like, basically, it was like basically 9 to 10, which should have been like some math. 10 to 11 should have been like English, science. You know, like we had a schedule. for 9 to 12, you were supposed to be doing schoolwork for 3 hours. Because you can't expect a child to sit on a computer and do schoolwork in like a natural school day. So then, after schoolwork, they had from 12 to 1, they ate lunch. That was their lunch break. They had from 12 to 1. From 1 to 2 o'clock, we did what we call genius hour. That's where they were able to create and do whatever they wanted to do as far as creativity, whether it was coding, drawing, writing, coloring, something that would kind of stimulate their mind and whatever they wanted to do. And then from 2 to 3, you had, after genius hours over with, you had career research, or, you know, looking into what different fields of what you might want to do with your life, you know, kind of jotting down notes and things like that. And then at 3 o'clock, from 3 till 10 o'clock, the rest of the time was yours to do as you please, you know, video games, TV, whatever. But that worked for us as far as a family and keeping them on the schedule and things like that. Now, that was in the beginning. And like I said, my sons, what they just, they'd rather just be with other people.
Yo, can I just say that I'm with you on that. And I hope that my listeners will have received this as a masterclass in managing a digital learning space. I'll tell you, like, when I get my kids up at 6:30 in the morning to run, they hate it. But I'm like, you're not just going to hang out.
Yeah, like I had to, right, I had to give them structure, because if I'm working and my wife working, I can't let y'all just sleep all day. So,
right.
And granted, now, my sons used to, now, they didn't think I knew, but I knew. They were smart enough, especially my oldest two, they were smart enough to be done with their work by Wednesday. They would think I didn't know. They were just like faking the funk by sitting there with a computer in front of them. But they were like, you know what I'm saying? And that was a blessing. Like, you know, as we're moving forward and people are trying to figure out what's best for them and things like that, it's one thing to have a middle school child, like seventh grade all the way up to high school, and having them do work, versus a elementary school kid, and you might have to kind of cater to him or her trying to, you know, work with them on certain things. You know, it ain't that simple. Like I said, you can get a middle school, high school student, and they can get work done. They're a little bit more self-sufficient. Maybe even a fifth and sixth grader. But those lower grades, you know, when I look at this, you're going to need help. And some parents are not equipped to help. And be honest, like, they don't, like, Common Core math is not for everybody. It's a difficult concept. It's a difficult concept to understand, especially if you ain't never, if you used to just, hey, you know your facts, you know your facts, and you kind of move on with your life. You ain't used to drawing squares and then breaking numbers down and saying this is, and this is how we get to 4 + 4 = 8.
Oh my goodness, wisdom, 2 snaps. so I'm gonna move to the next question. This is like more community focused. So what are some of the challenges that people in the community that you're teaching in are facing?
I think the community that I currently work in, it's predominantly working parents. And some may be working to the point where if they have young children, it's kind of putting them in the bind, like, how am I going to balance my schedule of work? And, you know, if I don't feel comfortable sending my kid to school, you know, where am I getting my help from? So on and so forth. So I think that is the biggest concern and issue, you know, and where I teach at. You know, a lot of parents are trying to, you know, balance. It's like you're trying to balance two things. It was one thing, like, when this first all happened and everybody's job was basically shut down, and unless you were considered an essential worker. You know, now we're at a point where everything is starting to open back up. They're starting to say unemployment is about to be canceled and everything else under the sun. So it's kind of like, what do you do as a parent in these districts where, you know, it may not, or let's just be honest, but what are you doing in some of these districts, these poor districts where working parents got to work, versus your influential districts where you may have somebody who's making $100,000, $200,000 a year by themselves, and the other person can easily stay home and monitor all the kids. So it's, you have this unbalanced thing in society and in education that's not just an Ohio thing. This is a United States thing.
Which leads to my next question. I think this, during this time, a lot of, especially in the education space, people are talking about inequity, and it's a buzzword. Equity is a huge buzzword right now. So when we think about the disruption of student learning that has happened because of COVID-19 and the way that it has revealed all these inequities that people are kind of talking around, you know, maybe this moment poses an opportunity to kind of reimagine student learning. Do you have any thoughts about, like, how we could make student learning different, or even like what we should learn from this moment moving forward?
I think what we can learn from this moment moving forward is that we can honestly make learning more 21st century focused, and bringing in different resources and technology and things of that nature. And what I mean is, we have realized that education doesn't have to just stop in your particular area. That with so many social media tools, between Twitter, IG, Facebook, Snapchat, you can connect kids all over the world way differently than what you could when we were growing up, when you just had a pen pal and things like that. You can probably do a lesson with another teacher from another state, you know, and standards still can connect, and you can kind of like have your students, you can even do something as simple as a class debate with another group of students from a different state. So what I think is, when we're talking about education now, we have to look at it in a different way as being able to make our students more global and moving forward into this new era, because we learned also that most of these jobs you can do from the house. We need to start preparing our students and that aspect of making them understand how this technology can benefit them. And that, you know, I've learned as an educator that just because these kids got all this technology, they don't know how to use it. They just have it. They know it's good for a social media app. They know it's good for a social media app, but you ask them to do an email, you ask them to write a paper or anything of that nature, they don't know how to do it. And then we wait to the last moment to kind of like teach them how to use it and how to be versed with it. So I honestly think that what COVID exposed was that we have to start, one, really taking our educators, our teachers and things like that, and giving them these tools and teaching them how to use these tools to be better at it and how to incorporate it in the classroom better. Because once again, we learned, because some of these teachers who may be on their way out the door, or they still might have, they might got like 5-8 years left, they're so old school that they don't even know how to use this stuff. And that was a deficiency. This whole, we learned that as well, that you got people that don't even know what they're doing, trying to teach another group of people who don't know what they're doing. So it's definitely some things that we need to fix as far as how to incorporate technology in the classroom and not being afraid of technology in the classroom, and realizing that this right now is a big part of our lives. And this is the way of education now. You know, we can do so much more for our students by teaching them how to utilize technology the proper way in their life, how to vet through sources, how to communicate. It's so many things that we're missing right now because we're scared to use technology in the classroom, because social media has made it seem like it's this bad thing. Like it's made social media and education seem like they can't come together as one thing, because everybody's worried about X, Y, and Z, or this might happen, or this might happen, or you can be unprofessional. Like it's too many things that keeps technology out of the classroom and keep us from going in the direction that we need to be going.
Is there anything else that you want to add as like just a cherry on top of that statement?
I would say this, as we move forward towards this school year, I want parents to be patient with educators, and I want educators to be patient with parents. This is new to everyone. There was no class in college that we took that said, hey, when a pandemic happens, this is what you do. We're still learning and growing. And I think the only way that we're going to be able to do this successfully is we do this together without the bashing of one another, without the constant talking about your district on social media and things like that. If you have concerns or questions, voice those concerns and questions to the teacher and the principals and allow them to try to navigate their way through this and kind of do the best they can. I don't think this is the where we're going to be at forever. It's a temporary thing. I honestly feel like, you know, hopefully by the beginning of 2021, January, all of our kids will be back in school and we can kind of like move forward and kind of progressing and into what we know is normal as far as school is concerned. So I'm asking everyone, just be patient and work together, because that's the only way we're going to get through all of this, especially, you know, with your kid. If your kids can see that you're being patient, then they'll be patient and we can all grow and be better, come out. I feel like we can come out of this better than what we went into it.
Orwin, those are super wise words. I definitely, like, appreciate you bringing all of that wisdom to our listeners. Like, thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for part two of this two-part episode. We hope that your family has a discussion about COVID-19 and your back-to-school plans.
If you have anything you'd like to share, please connect with us on social media at Let's K-12 Better on all social media platforms. Or connect with me on Twitter and Instagram at Mom of All Capes. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review our podcast. We wish you the best during the back-to-school season.
See you next time!